50% of what you learn in medical school will turn out to be either outdated or dead wrong within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is, no one can tell you which half, so you have to learn on your own. Professor David Sackett, the father of evidence-based medicine. Chapter 1. I did everything right and almost died anyway. We follow the science into disease. My mom was a dietitian. She worked in a hospital as a professional medical nutritionist into her 80s. I grew up steeped in that environment. We followed the food pyramid, the dietary recommendations, and popular nutritional wisdom. Every meal was low fat, high carb. We carefully replaced saturated fats with margarine, canola, and other industrial seed oils. The only omelets we ate were the egg whites only version to minimize the cholesterol. I thought I was getting healthier. We all did. Meanwhile, my mom worked in a hospital. Naturally, I became interested in medicine. I worked hard and was fortunate to be able to go to an Ivy League school, then medical school. I loved it so much, I stayed there and became a professor. That led me to teaching and learning from other doctors what I'd first learned from my mom, and then again in medical school. We all believed the same nutritional and health facts. The science was settled. From there, I learned and taught radiology. With radiology, or medical imaging as it's sometimes called, you need to be able to talk one-on-one with a neurosurgeon and also communicate with a heart surgeon and the OBGYN, obstetrics and gynecology specialist, and all different types of medical specialists. You need expertise in all areas where radiology affects nearly every system in the body and the ailments that the patients can suffer. Medical imaging plays a role in almost all diseases, so as a radiologist, you get to understand them all. In addition, I saw patients, treated patients, and prescribed medications. I did all the basic work of a doctor, and then some. I also did research. So much research. My laboratory received millions of dollars in National Institutes of Health, or NIH, grants as a principal investigator on medical devices, but also from drug companies, which I will be critical of later in this book. I was 100% a medical establishment person. I was pro-organized systems, and my background shows that. I'd served as president of major international medical societies, lectured worldwide, and been paid by universities, drug companies, and research institutions. My credentials were, and still are, clean. I was an unofficial spokesperson for the establishment. Then, I developed four diseases that I had been taught and had taught others were age-related diseases with maybe a genetic component. Hypertension, which needed high blood pressure medicine. Gout arthritis, and was also prescribed drugs to control it. Dyslipidemia, which is abnormal blood lipids, and for that I was prescribed statins. And prediabetes, which is glucose levels elevated in the prediabetic range. And for that, I was just prescribed another drug. My late father had developed all those diseases by his 80s. They had killed him. I was getting these diseases, but still had daughters under 10 years old. I wasn't going to live long enough to see them in high school. That made it personal. Obviously, I was concerned. And confused. How could this be happening? All the settled science told me that this was impossible. I was raised by a professional nutrition specialist, literally a certified dietitian, so I ate exactly as recommended by health organizations and the food pyramid. I'd been raised from birth in a system that assured me this wouldn't happen to someone my age. I did everything right, and I was going to die. That shock raised the alarms in my head. There was something deeply wrong in the medical system. I'd been fed lies, and I needed to know the truth. I trusted science that couldn't be trusted. Despite early death approaching, I was fortunate for two reasons. First, I happen to have a friend who was an acclaimed science journalist who had made his reputation pointing out bad science in physics and Nobel laureates. We would pass each other at breakfast in a cafe in Santa Monica as he worked on his latest investigation, while I went off to my medical school to teach students and other doctors what I thought to be the truth. As it turns out, he was just turning his attention to medical nutrition science as the ultimate example of science gone wrong and its resulting devastating public health consequences. His name is Gary Taubes, and his resulting series of best-selling books on nutrition science have revolutionized the thinking of a generation of medical professionals, and also made me re-examine my closely held beliefs. For more about my friend Gary and his research, check out Good Calories, Bad Calories, Fats, Carbs, and the Controversial Science of Diet and Health, and his many other best-selling books. His biggest reveal was that low-fat diets don't help us stay healthy, and they might be making us sicker even as we think we're getting better in ways that most people didn't suspect. That realization was a bomb going off in my brain. I'd been raised my whole life to believe the opposite. What else had been wrong? Secondly, my medical area of expertise is radiology. In this field, I was fortunate to deal with a diversity of different types of chronic diseases. Now, most other specialists, such as neurosurgeons, obstetricians, cardiologists, nephrologists, endocrinologists, neurologists, and ophthalmologists, often don't see the bigger picture because they are focused on a narrow area of expertise. As a radiologist, I could also see the actual disease. For example, coronary artery narrowing, blood in a hemorrhagic stroke, visceral fat, liver fat, malignant neoplasms, brain atrophy in Alzheimer's patients, diabetic ulcers, and many other complications. So, the direct manifestations of these chronic diseases were part of my daily work. With these tools in my hands, I began digging into the literature to try to re-educate myself. And I started to notice things that I had been teaching were now known to be wrong. What my old friend Gary presented ample evidence for went against everything I'd believed about nutrition, health, and longevity, against what I had learned from my dietitian mother and from medical school, even against what I had been teaching for decades in medical school, the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA as a professor of radiology. I saw how Gary's new health paradigm mapped onto the systems in the body I knew so well from radiology. How could I have been so wrong? How could the medical establishment have been so wrong? And for so long? For example, for decades, Alzheimer's, heart disease, diabetes, and arthritis were thought of as separate diseases. But the evidence Gary and other subsequent books, papers, articles, and studies purported to show is that all are at some level metabolic diseases. In fact, 8 of the top 10 leading causes of death in the U.S. every year are directly correlated with metabolic syndrome. We are in a medical crisis much worse than COVID-19, and most people aren't even aware of it. While chronic disease rates have been steadily climbing for the last 100 years, their growth has vastly accelerated in the last 20. Between 2000 and 2010, the percentage of middle-aged adults with two or more chronic diseases jumped from 16% to 21%. And only 4 years later, in 2014, it had increased to 32%. Today, a full 40% of adults in the United States have chronic multiple diseases. As a result, our healthy life expectancy is decreasing for the first time in recorded history. We'll get into why I believed and taught lies about disease, health, and human anatomy and physiology, and how they have become the predominant unquestioned worldview of the medical establishment. For now, I've made what many, both inside and outside mainstream medicine, might consider an extraordinary claim. That the medical establishment in general, and I as a medical school professor, taught lies. That requires extraordinary evidence, and it's unfair to make you read 100, 50, or even 5 pages of material to see that evidence. So, this section is a teaser into what you'll be learning about more in this book. By lie, I do not necessarily mean an intentional error with the intent to deceive, manipulate, or drive the public to an unnecessary early grave. Some lies are just the result of honest mistakes. Others, however, are intentional errors, some of which had financial incentives. For example, the American Heart Association being funded by sugar companies even as they kill the people that they claim to be saving. More on that later. And before we get that preview of lies, I must make clear where I stand. I am the establishment. I'm not a renegade, rogue, maverick, or conspiracy theorist. It is crucial you remember this as I lay out the evidence of fraud and deception and incompetence and ignorance. I will sound like a fringe conspiracy theorist, but I'm the face of the establishment. I received millions in grants from drug companies. I wrote papers for drug evaluations that the drug companies wouldn't let me publish unless they were positive. That is the expected norm, by the way. I have published hundreds of peer-reviewed scientific articles and over a dozen textbooks that are available in 6 languages. I've been elected president of 2 international scientific societies. I've held the highest academic rank of professor at 2 of the top medical schools in the world. I continue to hold that rank. Above all, I am a scientist, and that means I have to follow the science wherever it leads, even if that's away from everything I thought was true. I've also been practicing medicine, seeing patients, and have helped train hundreds of medical doctors, students, and other health professionals. The notion that we could have been teaching them incorrect things is an unpleasant possibility, but also a definite reality where our understanding of knowledge is fluid and ever-evolving. The idea that we could be teaching them incorrect things in the face of scientific evidence to the contrary, however, is deeply troubling. Unfortunately, both of these occur. And if they are occurring, we must tear back the cover to reveal the corruption underneath. 3 deadly lies I believed and taught in medical school. Number 1, the obesity lie. A calorie is just a calorie. We are now in the worst global epidemic of obesity that the world has ever known. Being overweight means having more body weight than is considered normal or healthy for one's age or build. Obesity is an even more severe state of having an excess amount of body fat, and it's not just the older people. 42.5% of adults aged 20 and over are obese, and 73.6% are at least overweight. Almost half of all Americans are now obese, and most are overweight. Obesity is unhealthy and a marker for metabolic dysfunction, which manifests as hypertension, diabetes, heart attack, stroke, Alzheimer's disease, cancer, and other chronic diseases. Our understanding of the causes of this epidemic and the approaches to treating it are based on a simple lie that a calorie is just a calorie, and with it the implication that obesity is caused by just eating too many calories. This is wrong for 2 reasons. First, calories in themselves are not sufficient to cause obesity. Some other control is needed. And different types of calories have different effects on this controller of obesity. To say that obesity is caused by eating too many calories is like saying that alcoholism is caused by just drinking too much alcohol, or that a heart attack is caused by not enough oxygen getting to the heart muscle. These are all, strictly speaking, true, but they give us little insight into any ultimate cause that can meaningfully affect the outcome. A calorie is defined as a measure of energy that food provides. We all need energy or calories to live. The lie is that it doesn't matter which foods provide them because all calories are created equal. And therefore, if you want to lose weight, just eat fewer calories. This lie came from the idea that all our energy comes from the calories of the food that is consumed, which is correct. The first law of thermodynamics, that energy and calories are conserved, is also used as a line of support for the lie. For example, a recent paper argued, quote, thermodynamics dictate that a calorie is a calorie regardless of the macronutrient composition of the diet, unquote. This is also referred to as the energy balance theory of obesity. But the equation calories eaten equals calories burned is a gross oversimplification. Because, as any person who has struggled with extra pounds knows, calories eaten can also go to fat, and also a small amount of glycogen storage, instead of directly being burned. So the equation should really look like this. Calories eaten equals calories burned plus calories stored. So the key control point for weight gain is how many calories are sent to be stored versus to be burned. And that number doesn't depend on the total number of calories, but instead on a biochemical signal in our bodies. That signal is produced by a hormone called insulin. Insulin tells the cells of our body to store calories primarily as fat. If no calories are sent to be stored as fat, then they will all be burned. There will be no weight gain. If insulin is turned on and fat storage occurs, fewer calories will be burned. If the insulin is not turned on, then no matter how many calories are consumed, the person will not store them as fat or gain weight and burn all the calories. An example is shown in a figure of a child who is unable to produce sufficient insulin in his pancreas. He is a type 1 diabetic. No matter how many calories he consumed, he was unable to gain weight. However, after 8 weeks of added insulin treatment, he had gained weight, consuming the same number of calories. Until type 1 diabetics receive supplemental insulin treatments, they will have very little body fat no matter how many calories they consume. As a physician, I also know from personal experience that I can make anyone gain weight or fat just by giving them extra insulin. This is seen in both type 1 and type 2 diabetics as soon as they begin taking extra insulin as a medication. So, to put it another way, calories are necessary but not sufficient to drive obesity. Insulin is required. Obesity is not just a calorie problem, it's an insulin problem. If all foods stimulate insulin equally, then a calorie is just a calorie, and it's not a lie. But they don't. Of the three dietary macronutrient categories that we'll be covering in detail later, carbohydrates strongly stimulate insulin, proteins mildly do, and fats do hardly at all. So a carbohydrate calorie will drive insulin more and weight gain than a protein calorie, which will drive more than a fat calorie. Ergo, all calories do not have the same effect on weight gain. Therefore, weight loss is not just about fewer calories. So the truth here is that in order to lose or gain weight, the most important thing is not the number of calories consumed, but rather the type of calorie that will affect insulin levels and direct our bodies to store energy as fat. As every rancher knows, in order to fatten up livestock, simply feed them large amounts of refined carbohydrates that will turn on insulin and drive energy storage into fat. Feeding livestock fatty foods will not have the same effect. What is the reason for growing numbers of obesity? The conventional wisdom and medical advice is that in order to lose weight and prevent obesity, we need to exercise more and eat less. It's assumed that it doesn't matter what you eat, just how many calories. Obesity is viewed as some sort of defect in willpower in the individual by not being able to control their impulses, gluttony and sloth. This is based on the acceptance of the, quote, energy balance model of obesity, unquote, which is taught in medical schools around the world. But as the success of Jenny Craig, Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem, and innumerable other weight loss companies demonstrate due to their recurring customers, it simply doesn't work. How do we get to this situation? During the 1970s, when attention became focused on heart disease and there was also a slight increase in obesity, U.S. politicians held hearings about how to best advise Americans about their diet as a national health policy. In 1977, a group of scientists issued the very first set of U.S. dietary guidelines, which the federal government updates roughly every 5 years. They urged Americans to increase their carbohydrate intake from 55 to 60% of their total daily calories and to reduce fat intake to 30 to 35% of calories. This was done primarily to do what they believed would reduce the risk of heart disease. Also a lie, but more on that later. This guidance meant people should eat more sugars and carbohydrates and cut back on saturated fats from meat, eggs, butter, and whole milk. Rather than consume what they called bad saturated fats, we were told to eat low-fat foods like skim milk and replace saturated fats in animal products with polyunsaturated fats from inflammatory vegetable oils like soybean oil or canola oil and trans fats. Interesting, 95% of the members of the U.S. Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee over the past decade have had conflicts of interest with the food industry. In 1992, these first flawed guidelines were replaced by even worse recommendations, what was called the Food Guide Pyramid. At the base of the pyramid were carbohydrates, particularly refined carbohydrates like breads, pasta, rice, and cereals, of which we were told to eat 6 to 11 servings a day. By replacing the consumption of fats, which have little effect on insulin, with carbohydrates, which strongly stimulate insulin release, the metabolism for most Americans who followed this advice was changed from burning calories to storing them as fat. The number of calories from fat was reduced, and the number of calories from carbohydrates was increased. By replacing fat calories with carbohydrate calories, we were turning up insulin and sending the message to store fat. And store fat we did. At about the same time that we substituted carbohydrates for fat in our diets, the obesity rate skyrocketed and hasn't slowed down since. The medical system doesn't fully agree on the actual reasons why obesity is happening or how to stop it. The problem is getting worse and people are dying. Part 2, the diabetes lie. Type 2 diabetes is best treated with insulin. Diabetes is an abnormality of insulin which results in elevated levels of blood sugar or glucose. In type 1 diabetes, the pancreas, the organ which makes insulin, is damaged and insulin levels are abnormally low. This used to be the most common type of diabetes, but has since been overtaken by another diabetes, type 2, which now represents over 90% of cases. Type 2 diabetes is caused by carbohydrates in the diet which stimulate insulin. Insulin resistance occurs when there are chronic high levels of insulin and results in cells being less sensitive to a given dose of insulin. This requires even higher levels of insulin, which can make the resistance worse, as sort of a vicious circle. 1 in 3 adult Americans is either diabetic or pre-diabetic, and 80% of them don't know it. Type 2 diabetes now causes 90% of diabetes cases. This disease results in abnormally high levels of blood sugar and insulin, which in turn damages the body. That results in blindness, renal failure, increased rates of heart disease, stroke, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease. We also happen to be in the beginning of the worst global epidemic of diabetes that the world has ever known. 10% of U.S. adults have type 2 diabetes, and like I said before, about 38% have prediabetes, which means for the first time in history, 48%, or nearly half the population, has the same metabolic disease. Remember the effect of the dietary recommendations on carbohydrate consumption and the resulting increase in insulin levels and obesity over the last decades? Well, those factors also drive the diabetes epidemic, although it takes a bit longer to get diabetes than obesity from the chronic elevated insulin and resulting insulin resistance. We show a graph of the number and percentage of the U.S. population with diagnosed diabetes, and it's similar to the previous graph of U.S. obesity rates, as both diseases are driven by many of the same factors. As we can see, common metabolic dysfunction, including insulin resistance, is the root cause for obesity and diabetes, as well as the majority of chronic conditions that we all face. The diabetes lie is that the best way to treat type 2 diabetes is with insulin. Giving insulin will help control the immediate effects of too much glucose in the blood by telling our cells to remove the glucose from the blood and store it as fat. That's what insulin does. But it will, of course, also raise the overall insulin levels, which will make the underlying cause of type 2 diabetes, that is, the insulin resistance, worse. Also, elevated insulin levels will in themselves drive other chronic diseases that we will be discussing later. But if type 2 diabetes and chronic insulin elevation is caused by a diet of too much insulin-producing refined carbohydrates and sugars, would simply switching to a low-carbohydrate diet reverse the type 2 diabetes? We show a figure of a man who was obese and had type 2 diabetes. Because his blood test for glucose, more about glycation later, HA1C, was abnormally high at 9.6%, according to standard medical recommendations, he would have been started on insulin very soon. Instead, he made a decision to start intermittent fasting and removed refined carbohydrates and sugars to make his diet ketogenic. He lost almost 100 pounds. His hemoglobin A1C dropped to 5.2%, or normal, and his diabetes is in remission and he is off all drugs. Knowing what we now know about the effect of insulin on weight, what do you think would have happened to this man if he had followed the standard medical treatment for his type 2 diabetes and started injecting insulin, which is what most people wind up doing? Our healthcare system is sadly much more optimized to deliver prescriptions for insulin and other drugs to manage type 2 diabetes than giving instructions on how to reverse it by changing our nutrition to avoid the factors that cause it. And to be fair, many people would rather take a pill or even a shot instead of changing their lifestyle. But most people don't know how powerful and effective lifestyle choices can be. And there is some evidence to show that merely improving glucose control with drugs like insulin or pills, unlike lifestyle changes, may not prevent some of the long-term complications these patients all face. This will be covered in later chapters of this book. And there are financial incentives. In 2013, the sales of insulin and other diabetes drugs reached $23 billion, with a B, according to data from the IMS Health, a drug market research firm. To put that in perspective, that was more than the combined revenue of the National Football League, Major League Baseball, and the National Basketball Association. Even the American Diabetes Association, which recommends the use of insulin and other drugs, rather than primarily restricting dietary carbohydrates, they received over $1 million from each of five of its top pharmaceutical company sponsors in 2022. The American Diabetes Association routinely gives advice like this from a 2008 publication, quote, "Sucrose, sugar-containing foods, can be substituted for other carbohydrates in the meal plan or, if added to the meal plan, covered with insulin or other glucose-lowering medications," unquote. We'll get deeper into insulin and even more diabetes lies later in this book. Part 3, The Heart Disease Lie. quote, dietary saturated fats and cholesterol cause heart disease, unquote. Heart disease is the number one killer in America. It makes diabetes and even COVID-19 and almost every other medical complaint look insignificant by comparison. It's also known as coronary artery disease because those are the arteries that supply the blood to our hearts that become narrowed, resulting in a heart attack. From early on, it was known that the atherosclerosis, or narrowing in the arteries that caused most cases of heart disease, contained a type of fat called cholesterol. That there was a correlation, but not necessarily a causation. Sort of like yellow fingers and lung cancer. A large number of people with lung cancer have yellow fingers from their tobacco use. These two factors are associated, but yellow fingers don't actually cause lung cancer or vice versa. Then, in 1913, Dr. Nikolai Anichkov fed high cholesterol diets to rabbits and found that they developed high blood cholesterol levels as well as classic atheromatous fatty plaques in their blood vessels. This experiment was specifically designed to finally demonstrate causation rather than a mere association or correlation. Dr. Anichkov's work has since been recognized as one of medicine's 10 greatest discoveries. Another author, slightly less grandly, called it one of, quote, cardiology's 10 greatest discoveries of the 20th century, unquote. In 1958, Dr. William Dock, who at the time was chairman of the Department of Pathology at Stanford University Medical School, wrote in an editorial, quote, thus the early work of Anichkov bears comparison with that of Harvey on the circulation and of Lavoisier on the respiratory exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide, unquote. The accolades are impressive, except that the work is based on an error. The authors overlooked the fact that rabbits are actually herbivores or plant eaters, for which cholesterol was a foreign material in their diet. Cholesterol only comes from animal sources. When the experiments were attempted to be replicated on omnivores, such as dogs and humans, who had cholesterol as part of their normal diet, the results were mixed, as we will discuss later. Next, in 1953, Ansel Keys reported in a landmark study that calories from dietary fat were linked to the incidence of death from coronary artery disease in middle-aged men from 6 countries. The data beautifully demonstrated a striking, near-perfect correlation between dietary fat and heart disease mortality, ranging from fewer than 1 out of 1,000 deaths in the Japanese who were eating less than 10% fat to over 7 out of 1,000 deaths from the Americans who were eating at the time around 40% fat, with Italy, England, and Wales, Australia, and Canada falling neatly along the curve in between them. This work was reproduced in later publications by Keys and would form the basis of Keys' diet-heart hypothesis, quote, that dietary fat increases cholesterol in the blood and elevated cholesterol causes heart disease, hence, dietary fat causes heart disease, unquote. This model has gone on to define medical thinking and public health policy about diet and heart disease for the next 70 years. The reasoning was clear-cut and made perfect sense, except that the data were wrong and the conclusions of the study were incorrect. It was later revealed that there were actually 22 countries with data available, of which Keys only chose 6 to make his point. There was little correlation when all 22 studies were included, and if he had chosen 6 different countries, he could have come to the opposite conclusion. The study was obviously falsified. Next, in 1967, Fred Stair, who was professor of nutrition and chairman of the Harvard University School of Public Health Department of Nutrition, and his colleagues produced a comprehensive review, quote, dietary fats, carbohydrates, and atherosclerotic disease, unquote, in the prestigious New England Journal of Medicine. The review concluded that there was no doubt that the only dietary intervention required to prevent coronary heart disease was to reduce dietary cholesterol and substitute polyunsaturated fat for saturated fat in the American diet. Now, it wasn't until 2016 that it was discovered that Professor Stair and his group had been secretly paid a large amount of money by a sugar trade group in order to incorrectly shift the blame for heart disease from sugar to fat, which the authors of the study failed to disclose. This was a clear conflict of interest and scientific misconduct. At the time, there was growing suspicion that sugars and refined carbohydrates were the real cause of heart disease, and the sugar trade groups had an interest in making sure that this message did not get out. We will cover this in greater detail later. For all these reasons, the world rapidly switched to a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet to prevent heart disease. Dietary saturated fats were replaced with trans fats, seed oils, starches, cereals, and sugars. By the 1980s, few physicians believed that added sugars played a significant role in coronary heart disease, and the first 1980 dietary guidelines for Americans focused on reducing total fat, saturated fat, and dietary cholesterol for heart disease prevention. All wrong. We will examine why this belief is flawed and how the truth can save your life. About the same time, the most profitable class of prescription drugs ever made were introduced, the statins. Today, this has resulted in a $1 trillion pharmaceutical and food industry based on the assumption that dietary fat and elevated LDL cholesterol are the cause of heart disease. But we will get into that later. According to the Center for Disease Control, or the CDC, 1 in 3 Americans is pre-diabetic, and 80% of diabetics die of heart disease. Heart disease is already the number one killer, but the CDC now estimates that even more people born since the year 2000 will get diabetes than generations before. That means that heart disease will rise to even higher levels of lethality. It's already the top Medicare expenditure. What is the CDC doing to prevent this life-shortening, first-ever non-infectious epidemic? Treating the symptoms instead of the cause. Treating the symptoms has at least brought some results. Unlike obesity and diabetes, the rates of mortality for cardiovascular disease have actually fallen, although it will likely grow again in the future. Some attribute this temporary decrease to the effects of the low-fat diet, statins, and coronary artery stenting. We will argue that the cessation of smoking, hypertension treatment, and improved acute coronary care units were responsible for most of this effect. Even with this decrease, the overall incidence, which is actually the number of people coming down with a disease of heart disease, is unchanged, and it remains the number one killer, above it COVID-19, cancer, stroke, and all the others. Many people believe that coronary artery stents or surgery is a treatment for coronary artery disease and that it will significantly reduce their chance of later dying from the disease. We will examine why neither of these approaches change the underlying course or ultimately the outcome of atherosclerotic coronary artery heart disease. And we'll look at the true underlying pathology and what can be done to prevent and in some cases even reverse this disease without drugs or surgery. All three of these lies were driven by the same thing: the insulin-producing, low-fat, high-carb diet, which was made a national policy in the 1970s, which was driven by the 1955 heart attack of President Dwight Eisenhower. That triggered people writing about fat-causing heart attacks, congressional hearings with Senator George McGovern, and food guidelines emphasizing carbohydrate intake over saturated fat. We flipped the nation's metabolic system from fat burning to fat storage. This drove the obesity epidemic. People began storing fat instead of burning fat. It wasn't that people exercised less and ate more. It was a change in composition which raised obesity rates. Then later, diabetes took off. We will also cover many more lies in this book, including about statins, strokes, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and even our basic understanding of aging itself. Then we will look at the fascinating truths that inform what we can do to both prevent and even reverse these diseases. Now, this is not a diet book. I'm not going to give you a strict diet to follow because some people follow a diet and still have a heart attack or other disease. It's not enough to just eat right. There's your genetics, your environment, and other factors such as stress, sleep, toxins, and deficiencies that we'll be covering. Instead of giving you a diet, this book will give you peace of mind because we will cover recommended nutrition and overall lifestyle plan based on the latest research and up-to-date science. Thank goodness the establishment can now at least agree that what you eat affects your health. But what does, quote, eating right, unquote, mean? There are thousands of diet books with subtle to widely different variations. And nutrition is not the only solution to the other risk factors, including environmental and genetic. So even if you eat right, you may be at risk for early death in your 40s and 50s and know nothing about it because you're not looking for it. Like me, I did everything right but still developed life-threatening chronic diseases that could have killed me. This book will cover diet so you know what foods do in your body and why. Way beyond what you've read before. We will also cover what best-selling and even critically acclaimed diet books do not. For example, tests you may want to consider, like uric acid or homocysteine. That's in addition to all the lies about disease. Plus, we'll discuss aging and longevity. There are amazing longevity breakthroughs tied to aging, specifically to metabolic function, and we'll talk about those so that you can take advantage of them and potentially add years to your life. Speaking of aging, you've been lied to there too. The lie about aging is that aging is merely from wear and tear on our bodies over time. We now know that's not completely true. Aging is programmed into some animals more than others, like Pacific salmon, who die immediately after spawning. Other animals we'll talk about don't even age at all. The single greatest risk factor for all chronic diseases has been considered aging, but not quite. If we get that wrong, we're wrong about a lot else about aging, too. You'll want to scream when you learn the truth, but it just might give you a decade or more of enjoyable years at the end of your life you wouldn't otherwise experience. Most of all, this book will tear the cover off the medical lies that I believed, that I taught, and that eventually made me sick, and to question those beliefs. You will learn the truths that saved my life and can save yours. It's time to get healthy. Let's go.